Good morning. My name is Dave Fredrickson, and I am powerless over alcohol. How did you guys do yesterday with the homework assignment I gave you? Yeah? Oh, what homework? All right. There's somebody that's honest. A few years back, before I moved to Flowermount, Texas, we lived in a little town in New Jersey called Green Village. And it's on the main train line out of Manhattan, so you get a lot of people that most of the people in the area traveled from that area to go into Manhattan to go to work. And on September 11th, we all know a tragedy occurred. And on that day, we lost a lot of friends, people that, even if you didn't know anybody specifically, it changed our lives. And as a society, we changed. One of the people that we lost on 9/11 was a member of recovery who happened to be the chaplain for a fire department that was one of the first responders to Ground Zero. His name was Michael Judd, and he was the FDNY chaplain. And when they recovered his body, they found the prayer that he had written, that he said. And I wanted to open this morning with that. And it goes like this. Lord, take me where you want me to go. Let me meet who you want me to meet. Tell me what you want me to say. And please, God, keep me out of the way. On that day, it was a beautiful day, spectacular. And several of the people that died, several of the pilots, the crews, were friends of mine, personal friends that I'd worked with. And it was a changing moment in my life, that event, because it welled up in me. I mean, I'd said my prayer and meditation, and I was in a very serene place. I was in a, you know, I had started my day like sort of like I started. Imagine yesterday, the experience you had yesterday, if you had a good experience here and how excited you were. And it's a beautiful, glorious day, and I'm thanking God for another day and for a chance to live in a decent way. And, you know, and I surrounded myself with the white light of truth and divine protection, and nothing that which is of the truth and form of good shall approach me, for I'm a child of God, and he shall protect me. And I'm out there with my spiritual armor on, and my wife calls me, and she says, David, get up here. You got to see this. And so I run upstairs and look at the TV. And my attitude shifted, and it brought into question for me my beliefs. And immediately I felt a kind of a wall go up in my heart, in my soul, you know, and anger started to pierce me, and rage. And it was one of those moments. It's the closest I've felt to when I first hit bottom, where I said, you know, God, help me. I'm powerless. I need you. Because I went from such a unbelievable pendulum swing where I was over at one side, and all of a sudden I swung into this rage, and I could feel it in me. And that's not the man that I want to be today. How do you handle that? Stop. I don't want to swing that way. You know, and I'm grasping for anything that can connect me to truth, to love. You know, but what's there is this beast inside of me. And it woke me up. It woke me up to the fact that I can go from that spiritual man to the demon in an instant, that it's still there. Now, if it's the thought of a drink, if it's my character defects that pop up during the day, I talk to them. If I see my disease and it's popped up, I look at it, and those of you in the room that know me, it sounds strange, but this is what I do. I'll go, I see you. There you are. How you doing, old buddy? Because if I see it, I know it can't bushmark me. It can't. I'm not going to get a strange mental blank spot when it's sitting right there. I can see it. It's right in front of me. Right? But here it was, a strange mental blank spot. Was emotionally, I had gone from one pendulum, and I'm being drugged out of control completely, to the other pendulum. How do you stop that? And what's not, my mind went to what's causing it, but really what I was really trying to do is I immediately went to my spiritual toolkit, what I'd been taught in recovery. I mean, by this time, I had, I don't know, at least, I guess, 20 years in the program or something. I should have something that can help me with this, you know? What's in there? So I go through the mental, the checklist very quickly. What's in here that, that can stop this feeling? You know, and I have to put on a adult face. You know, my wife's there and she's looking at me and she's asking me questions. How could this happen? What do you think? What's your opinion? But inside is that boiling cauldron of fear that I don't know. I don't know. I don't know how to handle this. I don't know what that means. Now, for those of you who are sitting in the audience, you're all reliving emotions that you felt in that window, that maybe not the day of 9/11, but in that week, certainly in the time since that time period, you felt feelings that you didn't want to feel. And it, for you, if it's if you're like me, it brought you back to when you're in your early addiction, you know, with growing up in my family, and I didn't want that. I knew didn't know what was right, but I knew that wasn't right, and I didn't want that part of my life, but I couldn't control it. Now, here I am in recovery. I've been given the gift, and I'm right back in that same place. Here's a big lump in my life, in all of our lives, that I didn't want. How do I get rid of it? And how do I not let it affect me going forward? Because one of the things that I desperately focus on now is being effective for God. I want to be the tip of the spearhead in advancing God's creation to make the world a better place because I'm in it and I'm sober. And all of a sudden, I'm not only not the spearhead, I am part of the problem. Very quickly, I'm becoming part of the problem. And I can feel the emotions. And it's sort of, you've all probably experienced it, where you're in a what a passionate discussion, and you can feel it start to come up. And your mind is racing 1,000 miles a minute, and you've got this, whatever this affront is that this other person you're communicating with has you know, this travesty to your psyche that they threw at you, and you're going to respond in kind. And there's that little split second where the voice goes off in your head and it says, don't say it. And you feel the words crawling up your throat, and, you know, and there's this fire, you know, coming from the tantien 2 inches below your belly button, and it's just, it's rocket powered. And here those words come, and on the way up, you're loading it up and you're putting barbs on the words and razor blades, and you're going to, you see the chink in their armor, and you are going to fire right through there. And the word, it says it again, don't say it. And as it comes up through the back of your throat and it starts to come out your mouth, once again, sometimes you might get a third chance. Hey, dummy, not a good idea. Don't do this. Everybody with me on this? Have you ever asked yourself, who's talking to me? Who's saying that? What part of me is trying to keep that contained? That's what I want to talk about today. JR threw his topic out at me, and I felt that come up in me. You want me to talk about transparency? And I went through everything I'd learned in recovery and all my spiritual tools, and it means something different to me. And I said, well, what do you mean transparency? What does transparency mean to you? And he's like, I don't know. What do you think? And it was like a shotgun blast coming out. My mind went in 1,000 different directions, and I couldn't grab a hold of anything. And I thought, what is it? And it led me into a series of meditations. And I started asking people that I know that are spiritual, what does transparency mean to you? What does it mean to you? And everybody gave me a different response. Everybody. I didn't get two of the same responses from anybody that I asked about what transparency meant. It was very, very interesting to me. And so it set me off on a path for 3 weeks, 4 weeks, a month, 2 months, I don't know, a long time. I've been working on this concept. And what has become absolutely crystal clear to me is that voice that calls to me, that says, don't say it. That is where I want to be. That is the man that I want to be. That's the spiritual truth in me. So I needed to give it a name. So I just called it, that's the I. That's the real I. Right? But it made me wonder, who's saying the nasty stuff? Who's loading the razor blades onto it? Right? My mind can think. I'm watching myself think. I'm watching myself go through this process. The I is watching me go through this. So I gave the second piece a name, called it the me. And the me really is my ego. It's the one that took the affront. It's the one that wears the mask. It's the one that has the label. It's the spiritual man. It's the father. It's the husband. It's the employer. And he puts all these different labels on, you know, and some people call it, you know, that person pushed my button. The me is the one that wears all these different buttons, because the me is the one that has to defend itself. The I doesn't. The I is spiritual truth. And the I connects to God. It's the voice of God that speaks to me in my heart. And I don't know if this is making sense to you, but it makes sense to me. So one of the things that I try to do is I try to stay in the I. So when I'm doing my morning prayer meditation, I ask God, the Spirit, from page 55, right? Every man, woman, and child, deep down within, is the Holy Spirit, right? So I go to that and I say, God, help me stay in the I today. Help me to be there. And then I attach it to that word I talked about yesterday. Watch. Help me to watch. Because what happened in that moment as this anger is coming up and it's getting ready to speak, I asked it in the morning, said, help me to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. On 9/11, I was loaded with resentment and fear in a nanosecond, and it was taking me places I didn't want. And the I spoke to me and said, you don't want to do this. You don't want to be that man, but I didn't know how not to be. Once I put the me on, with all the different labels, at that moment it was the patriot, and it was the friend, and it was the victim, and all these different labels immediately started chattering. That's the chatter of a thousand monkeys going off in my head. And they wanted revenge, and they wanted vengeance, right? But I knew that I couldn't withstand that emotionally. If I were to fall into that pit, it would have taken me places that I didn't want to go. Because, you see, the longer you're sober, the more you try to live a spiritual path, the narrower the road gets. The less I can withstand. When I first got sober, you could give me a resentment, and I could nurture that puppy for weeks. I knew that deal. You know, there's a wonderful line. It's one of my favorite lines out of the 12 and 12. It says, we wallow in the messy bog, getting a misshapen pleasure out of it. What poetry from Bill Wilson. That is me. When I'm in a bad frame, when I'm fully in the me, if I don't get my way, His Majesty the baby comes out. He throws a little temper tantrum, and then he jumps into the messy bog. You know? Only for me, and I'm going to give you a word picture that's probably going to haunt you, but I'm going to use it anyway, because this is where my mind goes. When I was in early recovery, one of the things that I did was dig ditches. And after a while, I started putting in septic systems and stuff. And in order to put in a septic system, when you put in the fresh tanks, somebody has to climb into the tank and cement the two pieces together. And guess who got that job? You know? So when I go to that place, what I envision in my mind when I'm in my messy bog is I'm sitting in the septic tank, right? And the manure is right up just underneath my nose, right? But it's my manure. It's warm. It's decomposing. It feels good. It's almost like being back in the womb. I feel when I'm in that little messy bog. And all I want is all of you folks, every one of you, to stop making waves. So I can just sit there with it just but you make waves, and here it comes splashing up, you know, and it covers the nose, and it's not a pleasant thing. That's my messy bog, right? So you with me on this? All right, so I don't want to live there anymore. I don't want to get pulled into the cesspool. But how do I stay out of the cesspool? And because the road is so much narrower, I used to be able to spend weeks in the cesspool. Now, if I have a harsh word towards somebody, within minutes, the I has spoken, I've heard it loud and clear, and we read it at all our AA meetings, you know, chapter 5. Rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path, you know, and it goes on and on. We read it so often that nobody even listens to it anymore. Everybody's chit-chatting with their buddies in the meeting, and why we waste our time and our valuable meeting time reading that over and over again, I don't know. But I digress. That's a separate issue. But there's one line that happens in that reading, and it says, we stood at the turning point. And I had a revelation. I used to think that the turning point was when I decided to get sober and come into recovery. I'm standing at the turning point. I'm going to stay in my disease, or I'm going to get help. I have now discovered that that is a turning point, but it's not the turning point. The turning point happens for me 1,000 times every single day. When I stand at the turning point and I get to choose, Dave's will or God's will? Do I go with the I or do I go with the me? Well, if I make the mistake and I go with the me and I take some affront and I say something to somebody, it eats me alive in very short order. I get into emotional agony very quick, and I've lost my tolerance for it. I can't handle it. It's sort of like when you're drinking. You know, when you first start drinking, you build up a bad drinking problem. You can drink everybody under the table. Well, if you go long enough, if you have that part of your sobriety, eventually you become a cheap drunk. You lose your tolerance for booze. Two or three beers, you used to be able to drink quarts and quarts, and now two or three beers will knock you on your butt because your liver's failing. You can't tolerate it anymore. Well, I can't tolerate the septic tank anymore. And so back to 9/11, I'm getting drug into the septic tank and I can feel it. And it wasn't, you know, sometimes the negative voice in me is nasty and sometimes it's ugly, but sometimes it's vicious. And I got nasty, ugly, and vicious all at the same time coming through the door. And I didn't want to go there. So I did the only thing that I knew to do is I threw myself on the altar. I said, God, I need help. I need help how to get through this. And it was a second spiritual experience like I've never experienced in my life. This calm and peace started, it just flowed over me. And it took me out of that. I was able to function. I was able to be useful. You know, I was able to call down to the squadron and do the things that I needed to do to start the process towards healing. And I was no longer a problem. I was part of the solution. And it got me thinking. And I started doing a postmortem. Why would I have been so affected so quickly? And how could I be that far off the beam when I had just been over here on this pendulum? And it started me on that quest. The same way that JR's question, when he said, I want you to talk about transparency, started me on a quest. And I had to start with the basics. When I do a postmortem, I say, okay, I need to get to a place. You can't start a journey. You know, every journey starts with a single step, right? But you can't start a journey until you know where you are. So I had to be where my feet were. I had to go back to this. Okay, I'm right here. I've just been given this instruction to talk about transparency. What's transparency? I don't know. So I asked a bunch of people. Like I said, nobody seemed to know. Everybody had an opinion. Very few people had an experience with it. But everybody started throwing their ideas out, and they thought, geez, that's kind of an interesting question. Nobody's ever asked me that. Well, let me think about it. I'll get back with you. So I went to the absolute authority in the entire world. I went to Wikipedia, you know. I looked up the definition on Wikipedia. Guess what? Wikipedia has no clue. There's like five or six different – it depends what they're talking about. They started out with a word that I really don't understand. They said, well, in the humanities, what the heck is the humanities? I don't know. In the humanities, it can mean openness. I thought, okay, but when I had openness in my mind's eye, I envisioned like that door back there. The door is open. That's not, to me, transparency, openness, but it kind of gets to the core of the word. And then they talked about banking, transparency in banking. Anybody that lost their 401k became a 201k knows about transparency, right? That's a sore personal subject for all of us. Then they hit on something which I hadn't even thought about. Transparency in communication. When we communicate with each other. And that sparked me a little bit. And I thought, wow, transparency in communication. Freedom of information. We talk about it with our government. We have the law, the Freedom of Information Act, where you can go get information that nobody wants. They don't want you to see it, otherwise it would be available, right? Sort of like WikiLeaks, right? If they wanted the information, they'd allowed it to get out. And I thought, wow, that's me. Because at the moment my pendulum was swinging from the positive to the negative, what really, when I got down to it and boiled it down and sat with it and sat with it and sat with it was, I don't want anybody to see me reacting this way. I don't want anybody to know that beast is still part of me, you know? And I saw very clearly the me, the ego. After all, you're a spiritual man. You've got all this time in recovery. How can you want to kill and destroy indiscriminately. How can you go to that place so quickly and be that comfortable in it? And that's what really scared me. When my mind went there, in a nanosecond, I was comfortable. It didn't bother me. When I was sitting in the me for that split second, I had no guilt, I had no shame, I had no remorse. And it brought me back to when I first got sober. Because when I first got sober, I had so far pushed my emotions down into that box. They were so far away from me, I thought, you know, the perfect job for me would be a hitman. Because I could kill anybody and not think twice. I did it as a kid growing up. I'd kill animals. I was vicious, cruel, torturing. And today that stuff can haunt me when I think back on that behavior. That's not the man that I want to be, you know. But I have experienced that, and I can be that man. And the one thing I've learned is, if I run from it, it will eat me alive. So I had to do something which was terrible, and I had to go back and embrace that part of me and say, yes, that is part of me. But how do I let it out? How do I let somebody see that part of me that's in Pandora's box that nobody knows about? This is part of me that I, you know, this is the take it to the grave type stuff that I don't want anybody to know, that I'm still, after all these years, I can still be that guy that's still part of me. It's a concept. It's a scary concept. There's a lot of people I can see in your faces right now. You're thinking, wow, I've got that in me. Until Dave brought it up, I was having a good day, you know? So, but I'm not just going to dump the problem on you today. I'm going to give you what I've learned as part of the solution, and it's still a work in progress. I'm going to be sharing with you my experience with this. And it's pretty neat. It's been very, very cathartic in a lot of ways for me. All right? So we're back on the word transparency. Then I went and I thought, wow, trans, through, going back to the little Latin that I know, and I'm thinking and I'm going, well, what's the root of the word? And what came to me was three pieces. For the TR, what kept jumping up in meditation was truth. Kept popping up. And hang on one second. I'm going to have to adjust these mics. My hip is starting to hurt me, so I'm going to sit down if you guys don't mind. And I'm going to have to sit down because I'm in a lot of pain. Can you guys still see me and hear me? For you guys over there, if you need to move, please move, because the balloons, I can't move the balloons. They won't come off the stand. So the TR for me was truth. It kept resounding in me, truth, 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 all right? And then I thought, okay, truth through me, truth through the word trans. I connected the two. I want the truth to come through me. I want to be a bearer of truth, and I could embrace that, you know, because I knew what I didn't want to be was the beast. We'll call it the beast. But I knew what I wanted to be was a sharer of truth. That I can accept. That I believe is what my God, my power greater than myself, wants me to be sharing. He wants me to bearer of the truth. The second half of the word that hit me over and over and over and over again, so I have truth through, was parency. And I kept thinking of parent. Well, I'm a parent. I've got kids. What does a parent do with it? You know, when your kid gets out of line, he corrects you back, right? That's what I hope my God will do for me. My father is, I treat him, I have this fatherly relationship. When I'm, you know, what does a father do for a child? They love them unconditionally. Well, that works for me. I want to be truth going through me. Let love run through me. That works for me. Provide what you need. Truth through me, I want to be helpful. I want to help people provide what they need. Parent, I want to love people. And what jumped into my mind was the guys that I work with as a sponsor, the people that we do spiritual work with. What am I trying to do with them? I'm trying to let love and truth go through me. It's not me that's the source. I always tell them, if you're looking at the finger, you're looking at the wrong thing. Look at what I'm pointing to. Let the truth come through me with love to help correct you back onto the path that I've found is truth for me. Does that make sense? I said, that's a definition of transparency that I can work with. That's a start of an embodiment, but I still don't know what to do with it. All right? So I started thinking more about truth, more about truth, more about truth. And what came to me was intimacy. Into me see is the way I break that word down. I want not only to let truth go through me, but it's got to be a two-way street, kind of sort of like the door. I want to let you see into me the same way that I'm going to see into you. Does that make sense? So I wanted this transparency. then what jumped out at me, and I was talking with my wife, and she says, well, when I asked her the question about transparency, she says, well, it's honesty. And I thought, wow, honesty. Cash register honesty. We all know about cash register honesty, but for somebody with addiction issues, either AA or Al-Anon, honesty is a whole different animal. It's not cash register honesty. It's lies of omission and lies of commission. And when you first come in, it's probably lies of commission. You stole stuff. You did whatever it took to manipulate the situation. The longer you're sober, the more that pendulum swings into lies of omission, where I tell you, you know, you ask me what I'm up to, I'll give you part of the truth. I won't tell you the whole story, even though I know what you're asking, is you want the whole story. You know, that piece of truth. So now I have this truth that I have to add in there, and this honesty, this real honesty. And that fits with the first where I started, in transparency, with the truth. Only it's not just spiritual truth, it's personalizing it and making it my own as a human truth, my honesty of omission and commission, all right, as I go through. But where was I? Where was the beast? The beast is in what I call Pandora's box. It's behind the wall that I don't let anybody inside. You know, intimacy, I envision, you know, you build this brick wall and you load up all these bricks and you got this huge brick wall that we've had our entire lives. You know, and the real us, the real I, is hiding behind the wall. You know, and we peer over the top of the wall and we're looking. We're looking out into life and we're trying to engage in life. And if I'm really close to you, you know, if relationships are on a scale from 1 to 10, most of my life I go through at the 1 or 2 level. We're acquaintances. We know each other. Every once in a while, I'll get up to somebody that's a 4 or 5. When you get up to a 4 or 5, where that scale comes from is, how many layers of my wall do I take down to let you see into me, let you see what's on the other side of my wall? A level 10 relationship, I don't think I've ever had one. As close as I can get is my relationship with my bride, my wife. You know, but even that, it's not pure. There's still some things she doesn't know about me. So I'll call it a 9.5. I've taken 9.5 bricks down. But I can put that wall up in a nanosecond. And the interesting thing is, when we have relationships, particularly in the home life with our parents and our family, you know where the chinks are in the armor. So you have these bricks, and there's supposed to be mortar between the bricks to seal up those little chinks, but there's not. Some of those bricks are missing the mortar. It's fallen out. And in your family members, you know where every single hole is in the other person's wall. And so when I was building that spear and putting the razor blades and the barbs on it, I was going to fire it intentionally through the chink. I was going to know where to hit. And I've done that with family members. I've said horrendous, horrible, hurtful things to people that I love in the heat of anger. That's what I'm talking about. That's the beast. And they know exactly where to aim for. They aim for the chinks in the wall. So there's some things that you can't protect from even your closest people. That's why we have the box. Now, the box is made of a different material. It's not the bricks in my mind's eye. The bricks protect me from everything. Everybody's outside the wall, all right? What's inside the wall are wounds. If I get a wound from my childhood or if in adulthood, somebody says something to me, that wound is behind the wall, all right? I wrap that wound up with steel plate, you know, because somebody figured a way to get through my wall inside to where I live, and they've hurt me emotionally. So I wrap that thing up with a piece of steel. We're still not the Pandora's box in my mind. The real bad things, the things when I deal with people that have had sexual abuse and rape and that sort of thing, that level of harm, the thing that you carry incest and all those, the real nastiest of the nasties, those stay in Pandora's box, and it's titanium. It's not just any kind of steel. It's the titanium. That's where the beast lives. The beast is in that box, because in sobriety, I cleared away the wreckage. I made the amends. I did the steps. I've had a spiritual awakening, but there's a little spiritual plaque. There's a little residue, and that residue is where the beast is hiding, that part of me. And I had to go into the titanium box and open it up. And what did I do? Just by sheer rote, by what I'd been taught from the earliest days in my sobriety, was I threw myself on the altar of God. I said, God, help me. God has the key to that titanium box. He opened it in an instant. In my mind's eye. And what he did was he shined the sunlight of the Spirit in there. And the beast cannot withstand the sunlight of the Spirit. For that split second, what I identified in my life was there was a split second of transparency was I felt the presence of God inside the box, and it made it okay. It neutralized the beast. You know, problem is, if I don't keep the box open and continue to allow the sunlight to shine in there, the lid closes and the beast gets his power back. And he's lying in wait for something to come along that the me will get offended by, and then he'll be coming out of the box with full strength. Does that mental analogy work for you? Do you understand what I'm talking about? Good, because I wasn't quite sure where I was going with this, and I didn't know if you guys were going to follow it, because I've never really talked at this level about this. I've talked with my guys. When I'm doing a fifth step, we'll talk a little bit about this, but this is me trying to be transparent. I'm letting you guys, the stuff that nobody was supposed to know about and how I operate, this is how I roll in me. So the question I would ask you is, what's inside your box? You know what it is. You know the things that are in the box. And here's the interesting thing is, the box isn't full. The box has got lots of room left in it. So if I take a little affront throughout my day and allow it to sit there, somebody's gotten a shot through the wall. Now I've got this wound that's inside the wall, right? If I let it grow and fester for a little bit and get a little gangrene mold growing on it, then I wrap it in the steel to try to contain it. When I can't wrap, when that's not doing it and those emotions are still squeezing out through the cracks, then I grab that sucker and I throw it into the Pandora's box and lock it under the titanium. And it grows and it grows. Well, how strong is my Pandora's box? You know, that's part of the problem. We did that throughout our addiction. At least that's how I see it. All the harms, all the guilt, all the shame. Every time I would wake up, come to, I'd think, oh, what did I do last night? Oh, and I'd immediately start the process of wrapping that sucker up. I got this huge, nasty hairball of guilt and shame and remorse of the things I did. And I'd wrap it in the steel, and that wouldn't be good enough. And I'd throw it in the box, and I could still hear it banging on the box. I needed to put the flames out. And the obsession would start. I know it will make that go away. That sound that you can still hear from the inside the box, let me out. Booze. Give me another round. I don't have that luxury today. What's my antidote today is God. Right? If you let God in, he'll heal what's in the box. But even that's not good enough. Because if you think about step five, we admitted to God. God already knows what's in the box. What a great risk to let this all-power, all-knowing creation know what I've got hidden in my little box. Yeah, like, right. Like, he doesn't already know what's in there, right? That's not the hard part. It's letting another human being know it's, that's the hard part. But you notice it doesn't say let God and another human being know it. The fifth step says admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. Where I'm trying to lead you folks today is to identify it, to own it, to embrace it. Whatever it is that you've got in your box, let yourself acknowledge that, yes, I have this beast in my box. Because until you do that, you're not going to have the guts and the strength to let another human being know that it exists in the box. And until that happens, true transparency is an impossibility. It cannot happen. I've never seen it. I've never experienced it. And the glimpses of experience that I do have with it only came when I would be free enough to let somebody know what was inside there. But it's a process. It starts with what? God. That fifth step process starts with a power greater than myself. I have to embrace the power and have the faith to let God take this deal. When I try to work it, it doesn't work. You can't solve the problem with the problem. I can't think my way through because the problem center's in my mind. I have to let God start be the starting point for my journey to transparency. So how do I do that? Well, it starts by doing 12 steps. I wouldn't tell anybody to even embark on this journey, to even listen to this. I should have put a warning. Do not listen to this CD unless you've worked all 12 steps. Oops, a little late for that. You know, you start with the 12 steps and have to have a working knowledge and experience with a God of your own understanding, this best friend of yours that you, that's what saved me on 9/11, was I had tremendous experience, and when I cried out to him, I could hear his voice. I've talked to several people this weekend, and I said, you know, you really don't know your God. And they're like, what do you mean? And they get all upset, and I said, you don't know your God. When all hell's breaking loose, and you call to him, you still hear the chatter of a thousand monkeys. And somewhere in there is God's voice. He's speaking to you. That little voice that's saying, don't say it, as the words are coming out. Problem is, you don't know what that voice sounds like. You can't differentiate that from the din of all the rest of the voices chattering. That could very well be the hitman that's saying, do it, do it, do it. You know, which voice is going to be louder? My higher power speaks in a still, small voice. And he's not going to shout through a bullhorn, right? So I have to be in the moment of serenity when there's not, hell's not breaking loose all around me. I have to know that voice. You know, you've all experienced it. Remember when you were a kid and you were in the middle of a huge crowd and there's lots of noise going on and your mother could be on the other side of the room and she'd call your name, David? And man, it was like a piercing spear came right through the side of your head and you're like, how the hell did I hear that? Because you know that voice. From before you were born, you knew that voice. I'm asking you to get in touch with the voice that you knew before you were born, before you knew your own mother's voice, that voice, the power of your creator. That's why I asked you guys to take that word creator and see what you could do with it. That's the voice you need to become in tune with. That's the voice that will allow you to start this journey, this wonderful journey that I've been on towards transparency. It's a neat deal. All right? Once you have the transparency, the even little bit of transparency, and you've done a proper fifth step and you've let people know about your beast, you're still uneasy. You're still on shaky ground because you've had this experience, but how do you duplicate it? How do you know it's going to work again? The good news is it works again. I've experienced it again. Since 9/11, I've had several issues that have come up where I've had to go back and try this process. So I've got experience, and I can tell you from experiencing really bad things happening, what I considered bad at the time, that the process works. The good news is that the process works. That if you have an experience with this and you identify what's in your box and you go through a proper fifth step and you get the healing that comes at the other end, all of a sudden you realize what was in the box was not a problem like you thought it was. It was actually a spiritual gift. You had to work through it though. You know? And one of the things that jumped into my mind was a line that comes from the big book. If I can find it here quick. It says, we grow, it's from page 124, all right? We grow from our willingness to face and rectify our errors and convert them into assets. That's what I'm trying to describe to you is, the greatest asset you hold is what's in your box. If you can face it and take it from a negative and turn it into a positive, the problem is you can't do that. Only your power greater than yourself, only God can turn it into an asset. But once you've had the experience, now you can share that asset with other people. It says on the next paragraph, 124:2, cling to the thought, and here it is, and I don't know how Bill Wilson was so profound to have gotten this. He had to be inspired spiritually. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have. Did he really mean that? Yes. It's the greatest possession I have. The key to life and happiness for others. Wait a minute. But it's all about me. That's the catch. That's the trick to this deal. You can't go in and embrace the beast, the thing that's in your box, to get it out to save your sorry butt. The only thing that you can do, the key to the kingdom is, if you're willing to go in there, expose the sunlight of the Spirit on the beast, with your intention is that you're going to have the courage and the faith and the relationship with the God of your own understanding to use it as a tool to save others. To do what I'm doing up here. To let other people see into you. Into me see. To let them see where you started on your journey. What was your beast and how did you process it? Then it becomes a spiritual sword, a weapon against evil. Because they're fighting the same battle within themselves, and that's the channel that you can pour into another person's life and unlock the key for them. But guess what? All you do is hand them the key in the prison that they're in. They have to unlock their own prison door to let themselves out of their own box. That's the hard part. You notice it says the next line, with it, with what? With this experience that the darkest experience of your life is the key to happiness, and that it's the greatest possession you have, that you can turn it into an asset. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. You can become a lifesaver for other people. Father Judd, do you know how he died? He died running into the Twin Towers, helping people, giving last rites. You know, something fell on him and killed him. He was helping others. He was saving others in the process. You know, what does it take to do that? All those guys to run in the building that's on fire, and you know it's coming down. And it's, you know, they don't stay up, as we found. Be the person that runs into that danger. That's what God has called each and every one of us to do. We've been in the pit of addiction. Whether you're on the AA side or the Al-Anon side, you've got things in your box. And with it, you can save somebody else's life. And that's what we're called to do. I am responsible when anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help. I want the hand of AA to always be there. And for that, I am responsible. For too much of my life, I've let it be somebody else's hand. You know, oh, let me call, I'll get somebody to take you to the meeting or whatever. You know, I'll do it when I can do it, when it's convenient for me. But I can even be guilty of pawning it off on my sponsees. Hey, Joe, come on over here. I got one for you. Shifting the responsibility. Have I fulfilled the requirement? Yes, the hand of AA was there for that person. But what if what's in your box is the key for the person that's sitting right next to you? Who are you going to pawn that one off on? You've got that responsibility. And what if my demon, the one that I've embraced, is the one that's going to save you? Do I have the right to sit back and say, I don't want to share it? I don't want to be transparent? One of the things that my wife gave me that was beautiful, it really touched me, was she says, you know, it's like frosted glass sometimes. When we first do a fifth step, we've polished our glass. We've let the sunlight of the Spirit shine through us, and we think we're just like this crystal clear lens that the sunlight of the Spirit is shining through, and we are. How long does that last? You know? Because if you're like me, and within a week or two, spiritual plaque starts to build up, and my glass starts to get a little frosty on there. And in a couple months later, if I'm not real careful, there's quite a bit of mung in there. You know, it kind of looks like the inside of the shower door when you haven't cleaned the shower in a while. You know, you get the little water spots, and it gets kind of nasty. You know, what happens if it's a couple years? You know, it can get pretty ugly, right? And in my area, people look at me like I'm a nut job because I do inventory twice a year, every January, every June. Start at step one, work to step 12, formally. Because I'm doing 10 and 11 on a regular basis, and you've seen how I do it. I work it. I work hard. I'm a mad dog. I was a mad dog drinker. I'm a mad dog in recovery. I work the hell out of this program. But who's doing the working? Me. Who lies to me better than anybody in the entire world? Me. I can co-sign my own crap so fast it'll make your head spin. And think that I'm justified in doing it. Because why? Alcoholics have delusion. We cannot differentiate the truth from the false. So when I work the inventory process every January, every June, I work with somebody else so that they can shine the sunlight of the Spirit into me. And they kind of go, really, Dave? You really think that was okay? Well, let me tell you something. And they share their experience. They've pulled something out of their box that they've processed through, and they end up saving my life with it. And hopefully I return the favor to them. That's why this process is so cool. When you first faced your first fifth step and you're going through your fourth step and you're doing the inventory, you're not happy about it. You're not whistling, oh, look at this, we're going to get some spiritual insight. This is going to be great. Oh, I'm so excited. At least I've never met anybody that's that way. You know. But if you've done this a few times, you will look back on it and you'll say, you know, that was some of the greatest spiritual experiences I've ever had in my life. That was so cool. The guys that I do inventory with on a regular basis, and if you're not laughing during a fifth step, you're doing something wrong. We laugh, we have a good old time, we itch and scratch, you know, and then it's like, it can even get sick sometimes because they'll be like, oh, that's your worst thing? Let me tell you, let me trump you, you know, and you start sharing these six things that's in the past. And when you can do that, I mean, we're talking some nasty things. People look at us like we're crazy because we're laughing about our past, but we're laughing because that we're not there anymore. That's a living hell. The gates are wide open. We walked out. There was no guard. We thought there was. You know, there's no guard on our box. except us. What's hidden in that box? My beast, there's only one guard and it's me. I can walk out of that self-made prison. Except it's a conditional deal. I can't do it by myself. I have to have the power to do it, which means I have to have a relationship with God. And there's the trick again. Do I have a relationship with God? So, what's going to be your legacy? What kind of transparency do you have? Do people see what's going on inside of you? When you screw up, does people know? My first sponsor, Carl, taught me, he says, you know, you need to learn to bleed on the tables. And I said, Carl, what the hell does that mean, bleed on the tables? He says, the longer you're sober, the more your ego is going to rebuild. Because once you have 90 days, now you're in 90 days. You're not a 30-day wonder. You're a 90-day wonder. You got 90 days. And then you're going to get a year. Wow, you got a year. Hey, I'm finally a member of the group. I got a year. I can speak. I can take a position, service position in the home group. I can do all these other things. Oh, you got 5 years. Wow, you got 5 years. And then all of a sudden, you're going to get 10 years. And then something's going to happen. And he said, when you enter the double-digit sobriety, he says, your life is going to get put back on the line. Because now you got something to protect. Now you got 10 years. That's something that's valuable to you because it was an experience and you paid for those 10 years. The thought of losing those 10 years is going to scare the hell out of you. And then letting somebody see that somebody with double-digit sobriety can actually have clay feet and mess up, your ego is not going to like that. And I said, so what do you do about it? He says, you bleed on the tables. You come into a meeting and you share your experience, strength, and hope. You let people see that you're human and you can still make a mistake, that you're just a drunk, one drink away from being drunk. He says, but there's a catch. You don't dump. AA is not your dumping ground. You don't walk in and you just dump your problem. What you do is you share your experience, strength, and hope. And I said, well, what the hell does that mean, Carl? He says, you share your experience of, I had the problem, this is what I did about it, and here's what the solution, the outcome was, and you give people hope that if they've done the same thing, they can let the sunlight of the Spirit out, and they can show it to the world if they go through the process. So now I understand what that means. I've got a very good friend of mine working a solid spiritual program, right? He's working the deal, right? And we're talking on a regular basis, and I've really connected with this guy lately, and we're really enjoying each other's company. And, you know, it's the holiday season. It's right before Christmas, and the man, he's excited about Christmas coming, and everything's going great. And he's at a meeting, right? And this is a guy with double-digit sobriety, high double-digit sobriety, right? And he's at this meeting, and he's in a deep, intense conversation with somebody. And here comes a guy who's always taking pot shots at him, comes walking into the AA meeting. It's right before the meeting's going to start. And they're deep in this conversation, talking about God knows what. And all of a sudden, the guy comes up and interrupts their conversation and says hello to the other guy. And so, being a spiritual man, he turns to him and says, hey, how you doing? He sticks his hand out to shake it. And the other guy starts to reach his hand to shake it and pulls his hand away and goes like this. Wipes his hand. And says, psych. In a nanosecond, the beast came out of the box. In a nanosecond. And he cocked back and he punched the guy right in the chest. Boom! Publicly in an AA meeting. What do you do with that? Right? The pain was in his voice when he called. I said, what have you done about it? He says, I've already took it to God. I said, great start. Now what? He says, I'm going to write about it. I said, that's right. And I walked with this man as he went through that process. And then he had to go back and make amends not only to the guy he hit, but to the guy he was talking with. And of course, that spreads like the gossip wildfire, because there was an Al-Anon meeting on the other side, and his wife was in the Al-Anon meeting. You know? That's advanced AA, folks. When you can clean up that mess, go to God, do the fifth step, share it with your spouse when she comes out of the meeting. Honey, you're not going to believe what I did. The shame. It wasn't shame. It was a nanosecond of shame. It was glory. It was a God-given gift to change other people's lives, because that man went back and he did the inventory. He shared it with every one of his sponsees. Then he went back to his home group and he shared it with everybody in the group. And he's a spiritual giant in my eye, because that man's walking the deal. He's transparent.
He let people see into him, and he identified and he's embraced that beast. I was talking with him this morning, and he says, "Hey, I got a follow-up with that story." I said, "Really? Let's hear it." Right? He tells me about how he's in a similar situation, and here comes another guy. It may have been, he didn't say it, probably was the same guy. Comes marching in, and he feels the beast coming up inside of himself. And he turns and he squares off, but this time a fist doesn't come out. A question comes out. And he says, "Do you know anything about sarcasm?" Stop the guy in his tracks. And the guy said, "What do you mean?" He says, "I suggest that you do study and learn something about sarcasm." And he turned around, and that was it. It was done. I prided myself when I was younger, when in my addiction and even early into sobriety, because I was a sarcastic SOB. Do you have any idea what a sarcast is? Anybody know? Everybody here know what a cat of nine tails is? It's a whip that they put nine strands on, right? That they used to whip the sailors with, and it goes way back. Even in the Roman times, they had these whips, these cat of nine tails, and the Romans, in their infinite ability to torture and maim people, they're the ones that developed crucifixion, right? At the end of the leather, they would make these little lead beads, kind of like you women would wear on your little bracelets, and they would tie it into the leather so that when they whipped you, the little lead bead would dig into your flesh and it would tear the flesh. You know what those little lead beads are called? They're called sarcasts. To be sarcastic means to tear and rip flesh. Is that the kind of person that I want to be? And what he was saying was a spiritual message to this man, because he knew when the guy went and looked it up, he was in a public place. How do I tell this guy, "Dude, you are so far off the base, you don't even know what you're doing. You're walking through life asleep thinking you're awake, and you're hurting people." But how do you say that in a public forum without getting that guy's ire up and having him react? And how do you keep yourself in cool? He didn't keep himself in cool. He had done the spiritual work to be transparent, and he was walking with God. God gave him the power to change the situation around. And I can't wait till I hear chapter 3 to that verse. When he comes back and says, "You know, that guy came and he learned about sarcasm," and finish what the process is. That's transparency. Does that make sense? Wow. Powerful, powerful stuff. So the question I have for you is, what areas of your life are you hiding from? And where does it start? I'm not asking you to go into Pandora's box yet. I'll get there. Let's start with the simple stuff. This week, let's maybe even today, but we'll say everybody came down to this convention on Thursday night, right? Or excuse me, Friday night. Let's take Friday. It's recent enough that you can probably remember it. What annoyances went through your day on Friday? Because that's what we're talking about. Left unchecked, those little annoyances, that the guy that you gave the bird to over here on Route 1, that's the kind of thing that's going to end up in Pandora's box if we don't be transparent and get rid of it. If you didn't do a 10 and 11 on it and clean that stuff up and share it with another human being, guess what? It's got a little coating. It's got a little plaque on it, and we're getting ready to wrap it in steel, you know? What struggles do you have? Who's that coworker that was just aggravating the hair right off? Your hair is falling off in clumps dealing with this coworker on the other side of the cubicle that's driving you nuts. That's your jewel that's going to end up in Pandora's box. That's going to have to be wrapped in titanium, and it's going to be knocking. And that knocking's not going to stop. What distractions do you have in your life? The 401k that's a 201k? The 25% pay cut that you took? You know? Wonderful gift. A wonderful gift. Hindsight. At the time, I thought it was absolutely treacherously devastating. My company, maybe 5-6 years ago, came to us and they said, "Hey, we're either going to go bankrupt if you don't take a pay cut to help us out." So I took a 28% pay cut. But in my job, based on what your situation is in your job, my seniority, I get paid by the airplane that I fly. So the most money I can make is if I fly the biggest airplane. Well, I got knocked off the biggest airplane because of when they constricted the company, I got knocked off. So not only did I take a 28% pay cut, I got knocked off my airplane, which was another pay cut. So ultimately, I took a 48% pay cut. Kind of got my attention. A week later, after this thing was done, the ink was dry, we had said, "Yeah, we'll save the company, we'll go from bankruptcy and we'll do this," senior management took $120 million bonus for themselves. Here comes the beast out of the box. Only I didn't put razors on that one. I put nuclear tipped arrows on that bad boy. I just wanted to get it close enough to take out everything in the area, right? And my friends who were living paycheck to paycheck at that point, they're immediately driven into bankruptcy. They're selling the little toys that they have, their little boat, their jet ski. Everything's for sale. It's a fire sale. But the problem with pilots is we tend to live in same areas, close to the airport. So we call them pilot ghettos, you know. Flower Mound, Texas is a pilot ghetto. I bet you there's probably 3,000 pilots that live in Flower Mound, Texas, from all different airlines. Because it takes me longer to get from the employee parking lot into the terminal than it does for me to get from my house to the employee parking lot, you know. Well, if you have a fire sale with 3,000 guys selling their cars and their boats and their motorcycles, you know, it's devastating. The ripple effect, you know, and it was just like 9/11. Here was another chance. Remember I said I had some experience with this? You know, I had a chance to process through this on a spiritual path. And when you start talking money, most of us, that's our power, that's our control. That's the one area in our life, that's our agnosticism. That's what we won't give over to God, is our money, because that gives us power, control, and authority. Guess what, folks? It says right on the top of our money, in God we trust. Today, I'm a steward of His money. There's a great parable that I tell at Big Book workshops when I do a workshop, and it's the parable of the drunk. Right? And he's absolutely in his height of his addiction, and he's absolutely devastated. And he's stumbling down the road, and he's half in the bag, and he gets that split moment of clarity, and he looks up at the sky, and he says, God, help me. I can't do this anymore. And he's in the depths of his despair. He's been given the gift of desperation. And a booming voice comes out of the sky and says, are you really ready? Oh, yes, Lord, I am absolutely ready. Well, how much money do you have? Do you have 20 bucks? Excuse me? Do you have 20 bucks? Well, yeah, but that's all I have. I got 20 bucks. Well, give me your 20 bucks. But God, if I give you my 20 bucks, how am I supposed to buy gas for my car? Oh, you have a car? Give me the 20 bucks and the car. Well, if I give you the 20 bucks and the car, how am I supposed to drive home? Oh, you have a home? Give me the 20 bucks, the car, and the home. But where are my family? You have a family? I want the car, the 20 bucks, the home, and the family. The cool thing is, I gave all of that to God. Because that's what our third step says, right? Made a decision to turn our will, what we want, and our life. It doesn't say our addiction. It says our life, every single area of your life, your work life, your home life, your finances, your health, your sobriety, your kids, your job, anything that you can think of that would have a little agitation in it on Friday that you were driving down here with, guess what? It's not yours. It belongs to God. What I want doesn't matter, right? I gave all that stuff to God. And you know the neat thing about that parable? The second half of it is God gave him back the family. And said, those are my kids. You take care of them. So I'm going to give you back the house so that they have a place to live. And I'm going to give you back the car and the money to put in the gas tank so that you can take care of my kids. That's a description of my life. If I rely on my power greater than myself. That's our greatest way to live, is if you can live that way. Well, here's what goes on. We want to give God everything, but we don't want to give him fill in the blank. You can have everything. Usually for the guys in AA that I work with is, oh, yeah, he can have my job, he can have my finances. And the one thing they don't want to give is their sex relationship. Not her. You know, I'm like, well, I was talking to a guy recently, and he's describing to me how he got physically violent with his girlfriend at the time. And I'm thinking, is that the spiritual man that you want to be, is what I said to him. And he's, well, no. And he had this shame and remorse. And I said, well, what are you going to do about it? You know, and I said, well, I suggest you write some inventory and write a sex ideal so you have something to guide your future behavior. And okay, Dave, okay. And I didn't hear from him for a little while. And what he did was he went back together with that girl, and she came and moved in with him, and then there was another incident in which I had forecasted. You know, I couldn't save him from himself. But until he wants to get rid of that, he's going to have to give every aspect of that relationship to God. Because you can't self-will your way through this. You can't think your way through this. And I've seen people do it with money. Almost anything can become your higher power. If you don't want to give it to God, that's what you're making it, a higher power. And my God doesn't like that, you know. I'd like a little tolerance, because I know not everybody in here is Christian, but guess what? The program of AA came from the Oxford Group, which is a Christian thing. So I want to read just a short little piece out of the big, big book. And I'd like you to have the open mind enough to understand. I'm going to relate the parable that he's talking about to us in recovery. All right? And it's in several places. It's in the book of Matthew. It's in the book of Luke. It's in the New Testament. There's two things that I wanted to read. First of all, it says, "You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden because of the bright lights that it shines," right? "Nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket." I didn't know what they were talking about. And what they're saying is, you don't light a lamp. You light a lamp to let the light shine. We come into recovery to be a bright light, to shine, to attract the sick people like moths to a flame. That's our primary purpose, is to help another alcoholic. And we're supposed to be an example, the shining example, right? The second thing that I wanted to read was, it says, "Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves." In other words, people that look good and they sound good and they're the old timer, they're the bleeding deacon sitting in the AA meeting. "You will recognize them by their fruits. Are the grapes gathered from thorn bushes or figs from thistles?" In other words, what's the life of that old timer look like? I got sober at a place called the Mendham Men's Group in Mendham, New Jersey. And there was a motto of that group is, "So you think you're working the program? Show us your family and we'll tell you whether you're working the program." That's hardcore, folks. That's transparency. You know, if the guy's sitting there with 25 years and it's his meeting and he's saying, "Yeah, I'm spouting all this profound information," but he's going through a divorce and his kids don't want to talk to him. And in his share, he talks about he's made 99.9% of his amends, but there's one man and I'm never going to make amends to that SOB. I'm looking at his fruit. That man doesn't have what I want. I'm looking for the 90-day wonder who's had the gift of desperation, that's just gone through the 12 steps, who's on fire, who's made all of his amends, just got his wife back. They're going to marriage therapy and you can look at the guy, man, I want to get as close as I can to that guy. Yeah, that guy is spiritually on fire. And once, to quote my good friend Mark Houston, once he figures it out, I want to get the hell away from him. Because he's going to be toxic. Because he's going to take credit for it. Right? Last parable, and then I'll shut up. Well, I won't shut up, but I'll at least put this book down. Bill Wilson got sober in East Dorset, Vermont. And I've had the privilege of going up to that place and doing big book workshops at the Wilson House. And Ozzie and Bonnie bought the Wilson House, and it was in terrible repair. The roof was leaking, and it was falling apart. And it was, for those of you who don't know, where Bill Wilson grew up as a child in Vermont, it was a roadhouse. It was a hotel, a boarding house. You know, for people traveling, they would stop there, and they'd rent a room. And in the back, there was a bar. And so Ozzie and Bonnie found this place, and he just retired, Ozzie did, and he took his retirement, and he believed so much in that place that he bought the Wilson House. And he turned it into a nonprofit foundation, and volunteers from the East Coast and all over the world now, AAs and Al-Anons from all over the world, come there and they volunteer their time for free, and they paint it and they fix it up, and they have a giant speaking room. It's about half the size of this room, and up over the top of it is the original bar that I imagine that Bill Wilson probably took his first drinks at that bar. And it's a wonderful, wonderful place. And Ozzie would always start out. He's, God rest his soul, he went on to the big meeting in the sky. But he would start with this parable when he read it. And when he first would read it, it didn't make sense to me. But it's got the analogy that I'll explain, that once you hear it, you'll never be the same. It's called The Return of the Unclean Spirit. And it's from Matthew 12:43. It says, "When an unclean spirit has gone out from a person, it passes through the waterless place." In other words, the unclean spirit that was in us went out into the desert because it's not drinking anymore, right? We come into AA and Al-Anon, we do an inventory, right? We cast out the evil spirit. Then the spirit says, "I will return to the house from which I came." And when it comes, it finds the house empty, swept, clean, and put in order. What did we do when we did a fifth step? We swept our house. We cleaned it up, right? We put it in order. Then it goes and it brings with it seven other spirits more evil than itself. And they enter into that house and dwell there. And in the last state of that person is worse than it was when it began. In other words, if you do a fourth and fifth step and you do it properly,
and you clean and sweep your house, you've had this God-shaped hole your entire life, and it was filled with the nastiness and the guilt and the shame and the remorse, and you took that guilt and shame and remorse, and you let God see it, and then you acknowledged it yourself through the four-step process, and then you shared it with another human being at the fifth step, and then you don't maintain your relationship with God. You still have this wonderful, cleanly swept place. And that unclean spirit will come back and bring with him seven other spirits. And I, as God is my witness, in the last month, I'll narrow it to this last month, I've worked with at least 20 men who have been in this program, and we're ranging anywhere from 2 years to 20 years of sobriety, or even longer. One guy is 26 years, 28 years of sobriety. Every single one of them, every one of them has been a good working foundational member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and every single one of them have broken off their relationship at some form or another with their relationship with the power greater than themselves. They've stopped doing their prayer and meditation work. They'd stop doing their inventory work, and they come to me when their butts are falling off. You know, they put it in a wheelbarrow, and they wheel it up to me, and they say, Dave, I need some help. And I'm like, okay, what do you got? And as for my 10-11 workshop yesterday, you know, the first question I ask is, tell me about your prayer and meditation life. And it's Swiss cheese. It's full of holes. And then we start down the path, and I get to this parable, and I read them this parable, and I said, now we're going to look for seven demons. They're all doing pornography to one form or another. Every single one of them, without a doubt, doing some form of pornography. All of them are spending money they don't have. They don't have a budget. They don't have the most basic things that we're supposed to have as responsible adults. They don't have wills for their children. They don't have an estate. They don't have a living will. Their administrative side of their life is a shambles. They're buying things they can't afford. Their spouse is going out and buying things that they can't afford, and they haven't had a conversation to say, honey, we can't afford that. They're putting money on their credit cards, right? They're comfort eating. Guilty. They're comfort eating. They're overweight. Their doctors told them there's something about it, and they can't seem to lose the weight. They can't have the fortitude and the stick-to-itiveness to go through it because they're trying to do it themselves. And so their weight is getting heavier and heavier and heavier. And I can go on. There's a whole bunch of different... The question is, we sit down and say, what are the demons? They're spiritual men. I mean, two of them are ministers, for gosh sakes. And I'm guilty of it myself. They're swearing like truck drivers. Their profanity has shown up in their lives. And I'm not against profanity. I use it myself sometimes as an emphasis point. But if I'm using it as modifiers and verbs and filling in the blanks, something's wrong. There's something behind me that's doing that. The seven demons are there. We just got to figure out what the seven demons are. And so if you're sitting in this room, don't think you're immune to this. If your prayer meditation life has got some Swiss cheese to it and you found that out this weekend, guess what? Look around in your life. I guarantee you there's at least seven demons. There may be more. And what I'm asking you to do is take a look. Be transparent. Look at those little agitations. Look at the things that are bothering you. This program says we get down to causes and conditions, right? Alcohol was but a symptom. Alcohol is not the problem. It's a symptom of the problem. So we go through the four-step inventory, and we look and find out what is the cause and the condition of what causes this to happen, right? And it says spiritual answers are the answers to all of our problems, right? When we straighten out spiritually, we straighten out mentally and physically, right? Comes right out of the book, right before when it's talking about the four-step inventory. So the answer is spiritual. So we go back and we start doing the spiritual work. I envision it. Oh, where's my big book? On page 62, there's a wonderful paragraph, 62:1. It says, selfishness and self-centeredness. So much we hear in the program. It's a selfish program. It's a selfish program. It's a selfish program. The original program, this book, it doesn't say that it's a selfish program anywhere. It says it's a selfless program. We're supposed to be helping others with it. All right? So it says selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. What happens with a plant when you cut the top off? It grows two. The apex dominance. You cut the apex dominance off, it multiplies, and you get two heads. You take a tomato plant, try it sometime. Cut off the top of your tomato plant, and you'll get two heads. Cut that off, and you'll get four heads. You know, it hurts the plant, and it multiplies. If we cut the top of our problem off, it multiplies. We have to get down to the root. What happens with the tomato plant, and you shake the dirt off, and you expose the sunlight of the spirit to the roots? The entire plant dies. He's making an analogy here. So selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of fear self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. That is the greatest promise in this book. Our troubles are of our own making. Because if I made my problem, if you were the problem, if you made my problems for me, guess what? You have to change for me to get better. You don't make my problems. You can't hurt me. I have to accept it into me. And if I'm the one that's doing the acceptance, I can do the rejection. I can stop making the problem and I can get better. And you can stay and be the exact same person you could be. You know, does that make sense? What a gift this thing is. It says, driven by 100 forms of fear. Self-delusion. What is self-delusion? Self-delusion is I'm lying to myself, right? Well, why am I lying to myself? Because I really don't want to see what's there. So I'm afraid. So underneath self-delusion is a fear, right? Self-seeking. What is self-seeking? I'm afraid I'm not going to get what I want. So I'm going to do the manipulation to get what I want. Once again, what's underneath self-seeking? Fear. Self-pity. I'm afraid I'm always going to stay this way. So I'm going to sit down in the pity party. Nobody's paying attention to me, so I'm going to throw a little pity party, get some attention. What's drawing that in is fear. I'm afraid of being alone, afraid of being hurt, afraid of not getting what I want. You could rewrite this sentence. Selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, 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 and fear, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. AA's and Al-Anon's folks were fear generators, right? It says earlier in the book that faith, and I'll read it to you. Everybody says we just don't drink one day at a time in AA. That's not what this book says. It absolutely doesn't say we quit drinking one day at a time. Let me read to you what it does say. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us or we perish, meaning we die. It's not just good enough for me to have faith and to have this belief that God is going to take care of me. That's having faith in me. Remember I said it's a conditional. There's a square around the word and. I have to have faith in me and it has to work through me. I have to be the channel. I have to have transparency. I have to spread my faith and step out and take some action based solely on my relationship with God, that I know that he's got my back and he's going to take care of me. I put on my Roman armor that I talked about. My back is exposed. God has got my back. I can go out and do spiritual battle because he's got my back. Does that make sense? So we go through our lives and these little agitations that are coming up, the driver, the little white hair puff that pulls out in front of you and she's down behind, you know, and you're busy going someplace. You got things to do. You're afraid you're going to be late. There's a fear that's driving you. The boss that's an idiot, you're afraid that he's always going to be your boss and that you're always going to be agitated by him and you're going to have to work there for the rest of your days and you don't know if you can take it. Your spouse that always does, how could she possibly put the toilet paper on the roll that way? Don't you understand the basics that it doesn't go that way? Driven by 100 forms of fear, 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 and fear. Don't focus on the fear. Focus on the cause. It's like a game of whack-a-mole. You know, the mole pops up, you take that big foamy hammer and you smack it down and it pops over there and you smack it down. Your arm is going to get tired, folks. What's causing the moles to jump up? What's causing the fears to pop up is the areas of your life that you haven't given over to God. Into me see. Go do the inventory. Let God see what's in there. Admit it to yourself. Share it with another human being. And now you have a spiritual weapon to go do battle and save other people's lives with. That's transparency. Especially with the stuff that happened in your personal life, your sexual life. I'm not saying go spread it at an AA meeting, an open AA meeting. But when you're in a meeting and you hear somebody that's struggling, saddle up alongside that person and say, hey, if you really want to do some work, I've done some experience with this. Let's talk. And you can help them process through that because you've got a unique experience that nobody else does. You know, in your relationships, I got how much? 5 minutes. All right, we're going to wrap this thing up. There's a whole bunch of tools that we have. You know, remember I said I worked the 12 steps. I worked the 12 steps for myself. But I also work 12 steps in my marriage. My wife and I, we work the 12 traditions. We work the 12 concepts in our marriage. We're supposed to practice these principles in all our affairs. There's a whole bunch more principles in this book. If you read the chapter, Two Wives and the Family Afterwards, you know, there's the principle of that we should never be angry. Did Bill Wilson really mean that? Did he write that in this book? Guess what? He did. It's in there. We should never be angry. There's a never. Never must have twos, right? Never am I supposed to be angry. But I'm angry all the time. Why? Anger is always what? Secondary emotion. It's never primary. I'm afraid of something. You know, when if JR were to stand up right now and punch me in the arm, what hurt me? His fist. Am I mad at his fist? Absolutely not. Am I mad at his arm? Absolutely not. I'm mad at JR. I'm mad at the source. Let's not get caught up in the sense, in the anger. Let's go on a fear hunt. It's like an Easter egg hunt. Let's dig around in there. Let's find the demons in your life. What agitates you? If you're the tornado roaring through your life, if you've truly given all the different areas of your life to God, your work life, your sex life, your home life, and don't just use the big banners. Break it down to its essence. Let's take financial life. Everybody loves this. I've given my financial life over to God. Oh, really? Let's talk about that. So what you're saying is you've given your work life over to God and how much money you make. Well, of course. Well, what about your retirement? Well, I really don't have – my retirement's kind of shaky. Give it to God. Let's do some positive area work in that area. What about your budget? What budget? Oh, you don't have a budget, so you haven't given it over to God. Okay. Now, what about your spending money, your cash that you carry in your pocket? You don't even keep track of how much that's going out. What about – what are you going to leave to your kids? What about savings? Do you have a saving? Do you have – these financial planners will tell you you're supposed to have 8 months' worth of salary as a safety net. Who in here has got 8 months' worth of salary as a safety net? I mean, there's what, six to seven hands in the room, right? When you give that stuff over to God, you don't have to have it instantly, but he will help you give the money to build that stuff, but you have to have a plan to start with. That's my point. Fear is driving us. So if you want transparency in your life, you go on a fear hunt. You expose it to the sunlight of the Spirit. Page 68 gives us a great tool to outgrow fear. It says we offer it to God, and then we ask God to show us what he would want us to be. Not what does he want us to do. What does he want to be? When I'm afraid, what does God want me to be? Trusting, faithful, courageous. You know, he wants me to take action. So I don't focus on the fear. I give the fear to God. He has to remove it. I can't solve the problem with the problem. If I'm afraid, I can't take it away. Give it to God. I focus myself on the spiritual truth of what God wants me to be. I try to be transparent. Trust me, it is a scary, scary business to be transparent. It can get very lonely out at the tip of that spear if you're out there by yourself. I would not suggest anybody step out and be the tip of the spear if God doesn't have your back, because you will very quickly fail, because on your own power, you don't have the power to do spiritual battle. Get yourself a higher power. Get yourself a God. And if you don't know your God, and I guarantee you there's a lot of people in this room that have no idea of their God, take this exercise. Look at the fruit. Look at the little aha moments, if you've had those this weekend. And we get an aha moment, and then we want to listen to the speaker some more, and we get another aha moment, we look at it, we throw it aside, and we get another aha, and we throw it aside. Go back and collect up all those little aha moments you've had this weekend and suck the marrow out of that bone. Feel the presence of God who gave you that aha moment, and then apply it to your life. Get to know your God. Do you have an angry God or a jealous God? Do you have a loving God or a compassionate God? Get to know your God and then throw yourself unreservedly under his care and protection, and he'll carry you through life. And you're on the greatest road. What is my legacy? My legacy is I want to have left this world a better place because I'm alive, because I was here, you know, that I was a dash. My dash meant a difference. I've left something behind. I've made it a better place. Because I sure as hell destroyed this world. As a drug dealer, I destroyed families all over the place. How do you make amends for that? By helping the families you can. You know, I thank you from the bottom of my heart for this opportunity to share with you guys. I've had a wonderful time this weekend. I hope you have too. If I've said something that has agitated you and irritated you at a core level, thank God I did. God's grace lasts only as long as ignorance. If I've said something that's agitated, you can no longer go into your life successfully and ignore it. I have put a burr under your saddle, and it's going to fester until you face up to it. The quicker you get to this program and work the steps, the quicker you will find freedom like nothing has ever happened to you. And you can join me shoulder to shoulder on the broad highway as we trudge the road to happy destiny. Thank you, and God bless you.